The role of religion in politics. With important elections scheduled for this coming November, the role of religion in politics is an issue about which we need to be informed. Already in the televised debates, we have seen candidates asked whether they believe everything in the Bible is true. And the obvious reluctance of anyone to answer in the negative, or even indicate some doubt about that, for fear of losing the support of many voters. The term culture wars was first popularized by James Davison Hunter in his book, Culture Wars: The Struggle to Define America. He described the two opposing views as progressivism and orthodoxy. Commentator Bill O'Reilly has used the terms secular progressives and traditionalists to describe these opposing viewpoints. In general, the progressives have favored the separation of church and state, and using the courts to restrain the power of the religious fundamentalists, while the traditional religionists have favored using their political power to enact laws which advance their religious views. I think we need to take a longer view of this situation. Throughout most of human history, in most places, political leaders and religious leaders have worked together to rule the society, theoretically to promote the good of everyone in the society against outsiders, but also simultaneously taking good care of themselves. When humanity made the transition from tribes to larger organized communities at the time of the agricultural revolution about 10,000 years ago, we saw the beginning of governments ruled by kings and their allies. And at the same time, also the beginning of group religious rituals and practices controlled by the priests and scribes. The political authorities used physical force, well-paid armies and other employees to collect taxes and control the people in their own community, as well as to expand their power over other groups. The religious authorities use their influence to tell people what to believe and how obedience to the authorities, both political and religious, was their highest duty. This included the notion that supernatural forces, as well as the government, would punish them if they didn't obey. The biblical story of Adam and Eve being cast out of the Garden of Eden is a good example of this. What was their sin? What was it that they did that caused them to be thrown out of the garden? It was disobedience. They dared to, as some people would put it, question the old man instead of just obeying. The period of agrarian communities lasted from about 8,000 before the Common Era to about 1800 AD, when the Industrial Revolution began in Northern Europe and North America. During this long agrarian period, only 1 to 2% of the people knew how to read and write. All the others were out there working in the fields. As a result, this small literate group felt superior. And the rest of the population also believed that they were superior. After all, they could do this magic thing called reading and writing. The educated few were the leaders of the religious community and also the employees of the leaders of the political community. The knowledge of this agrarian period is described as classical knowledge by economist Kenneth Boulding when he's discussing the history of human development. Classical knowledge consists of studying the sacred writings containing the teachings of the wise men of that society, such as Confucius, Lao Tse, Zarathustra, Moses, Buddha, Jesus, and Muhammad. These wise men were speaking the truth, and it was written down in these scriptures. These classics, written between about 1500 before the Common Era and 700 AD, became the basis for the world's traditional religions that we still hear about today, whether it's Hinduism, Confucianism, Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, have their sources in this one period of time. An important characteristic of this classical knowledge is that it is the literature studied by those learning how to read and write. This is what they use to learn how to read. It is regarded as sacred and not to be questioned. Who are you to question the wise men of our culture? This attitude of reverence toward the Bible and the Quran is still adopted by fundamentalists. They are ignorant and totally unaware of how old, how ancient, and pre-scientific these writings are. Even in agrarian societies, however, a few people did question this sacred knowledge. These were the first philosophers and scientists, men such as Thales, Democritus, Socrates, Aristarchus, and Epicurus, just to name a few, who were questioning these authorities who controlled the political and religious situation. The spread of this philosophical questioning and requiring knowledge to be based on experimentation rather than speculation was slow because of vigorous persecution by the political and religious authorities. But gradually things changed. In Europe, in the 1400s, two critical developments occurred which began to break the power of the traditional authorities. First was the introduction of gunpowder and guns, which began to undermine the power of the political elites who depended on trained military forces that could be canceled out by guns. And the second was Gutenberg's invention of the movable type printing press in 1450, which was crucial in undermining the power of the religious elites, because books suddenly became much more common and affordable. In the early 1500s, a decisive break in the power of the religious authorities came with the Protestant Reformation, led by Martin Luther and John Calvin. The focus of the Protestants was on having the parishioners read the Bible for themselves, rather than relying on current religious authorities to teach them about the church's teachings. During the next 150 years, the political leaders, the kings, determined whether their subjects would be Catholics or Protestants. We had the Hundred Years' War and then the 30 Years' War. There was no doubt at this time that the proper role of religion and religious leaders was to support the political authority in whatever country they were. Whatever the king said, that was what everybody had to believe. In 1568, King Sigismund of Transylvania, that many of us have heard of, a Unitarian king, issued the famous Edict of Toleration, which permitted individuals to be Catholics or Protestants or Unitarians. It did not include atheists, only people with one or another religious belief. But that was a big break from what the usual practice of the day was. At the same time, at the same period, a few scientists such as Copernicus and Galileo were making and publicizing discoveries which conflicted with the Bible and also with what the religious authorities were saying was true about the relation between the earth and the sun. The spreading knowledge about these discoveries greatly undermined religious authorities, both the institutional Catholic Church and the text of the Bible on which the Protestants relied. The rise of Protestantism and the emphasis on reading the Bible was accompanied by expanded use of national languages rather than having everything written in Latin, which not many people were able to read. Now, during this movement, the Catholic Church did not sit idly by. They called the Council of Trent, 1545 to 1563, and sought to modernize the Catholic Church and restore the authority of the Pope over the Church. This effort to revitalize the Church led to implementation of the Inquisition to drive out heretics and doubters from the Church, as well as the creation of the Index of Books, which Catholics were prohibited from reading. So here we see the first effort to fight back against the gradual dissolution of authority, which is taking place. Another development during the 1700s in Northern Europe that the weakening of religious authority helped because of less restrained acquisition of new scientific knowledge in the physical sciences, and this in turn led to the development of the steam engine and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So we see how one breaking of authority after another breaking of authority eventually leads to the Industrial Revolution. The spread of literacy, of being able to read, and the questioning of authority, both political and religious, reached its peak in the 18th century Enlightenment. The American Revolution, that is the separation of the American colonies from England, and the French Revolution were both manifestations of the influence of Enlightenment thinking, thinking which emphasized opposition to authority, critical, rational, scientific thinking, education for everyone, not just the elite, faith in social progress and in the inherent goodness of people, natural religion based on the observed order in nature as opposed to revealed religion imposed by authority, and basic human rights for all. These were the basic ideas of the Enlightenment. The cry of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, fraternity, beautifully sums up the ideals of the Enlightenment. In his book, The Age of Reason, Thomas Paine, who played a part in both the American Revolution and the French Revolution, provides the arguments and the details. If you want to get a good view of the Enlightenment, read The Age of Reason by Thomas Paine. The U.S. Declaration of Independence also applies Enlightenment ideals to political questions. It is worth noting that in England, where the battle for liberty seems to have begun with the Magna Carta in 1215, there was nevertheless a widespread movement led by conservatives such as Edmund Burke against the excesses of the French Revolution. Excesses which in fact ended in the dictatorship of Napoleon Bonaparte. The British did help to defeat him at Waterloo in 1815, and this was followed by a century of global dominance by the British Empire. But the big thing here is to see that the English, at this point, we became a little bit suspicious of the French and these ideas of liberty. The 18th century is also when the Industrial Revolution begins to produce the great transition from an agrarian society to an industrial society, where humans become less directly dependent on nature and more on human ingenuity and manufactured goods. One great difference between an agrarian society and an industrialized society is the increase in the proportion of people who can read and write. Skills that individuals must have in an industrialized society. Once people were more educated, they are more ready to think for themselves and less inclined to accept authority, political or religious. Then democracy can replace authoritarian regimes, and religious authorities are more likely to be questioned by their parishioners. Now, from the time of the Enlightenment in the 18th century onward, we have had culture wars between the adherents of the Enlightenment faith in reason and progress, on the one hand, and those who reject it by appealing to some religious authority, the church, the Bible, the Quran, on the other. The optimistic, rational, liberal Enlightenment outlook has also been attacked by other opponents advancing anti-rational, anti-scientific, romantic, intuitionist views, or some authoritarian, secular, anti-liberal ideology like Marxism, communism, or fascism. But the term culture wars is typically reserved for those struggles between the philosophical, scientific, pro-Enlightenment intellectuals on the one side and the religious traditionalists on the other. One such culture war of free thinkers versus champions of traditional religious faith occurred in the earliest years of this country. It is described in the article America's Founding Faiths by Unitarian Minister Forrest Church in the most recent UU World for winter 2007, a magazine which all members of this church should have received in the past month. And if you're not a member, this is a good reason to become a member, because then you become a subscriber to the UU World. The cover features a painting of Thomas Jefferson with his draft of the Declaration of Independence, plus the words divine order versus sacred liberty, the theme of this article by Church, by Forrest Church, who's a Unitarian minister. One of the interesting aspects of this first mentioned culture war is that we had Unitarians leading both of the opposing factions. The leader of the divine order faction was God-fearing Anglophile New Englander John Adams, while the leader of the sacred liberty faction was free-thinking Francophile Virginian Thomas Jefferson. The divine order faction led by Adams believed that the new nation, and this is a quote, would not survive independent of strong Christian government. While minority groups, such as the Baptists, the Methodists, the Jews, the Roman Catholics, and non-Christian deists, adopted the view that religious liberty required strict separation of state and church. They were the minorities. It is worth remembering, as Forrest Church notes in his article, that at this time, the Presbyterians, the Episcopalians, the Quakers, the Congregationalists, and even the Unitarians had become accustomed to operating under government protection and support. They were the establishment. In 1798, when he was president, Adams even proclaimed a national day of fasting to show that the American people are committed to establishing a Christian commonwealth. But the Baptists and the Methodists viewed this event as merely an effort to give a boost to the mainline churches of that day, whose public support was lagging. Not entirely different from the way that the state churches in Europe are facing a problem of lagging attendance now. Church notes that George Washington believed in Providence, but attended church mainly just to accompany his wife, Martha. He never participated in the communion part of the service. He always left before the communion part. He agreed with the idea of religious liberty and that each citizen, quote, ought to be protected in worshiping the deity according to the dictates of his own conscience, end of quote. But he was also concerned that religious groups could cause trouble by their involvement in politics. Although Forrest Church fails to note this in his article, George Washington, like many of the founding fathers, was a Freemason, a member of the non-denominational, non-Christian lodge for those who believe in a divine being and the brotherhood of man. And incidentally, if you look at your dollar bill, you'll see a lot of Mason symbols on the dollar bill, showing the extent to which many of our founding fathers were Freemasons. We know that John Adams was a Unitarian, but it is important for this discussion to note Church's comments about Adams. Quoting now, Adams fell several tenets short of the requirements of Orthodox Christianity. For starters, he rejected original sin and the doctrine of predestination. The atonement, the idea Christ died for our sins, fit nowhere in his theology. He didn't think like a true believer, but he felt like a true believer. A lifelong church-going animal like his fathers and mothers before him, to Adams, the Bible was the best book in the world, and Christianity the one indispensable guarantor of public morality. When Jefferson ran against Adams in the 1800 election, one of the most interesting elections in the history of this country, and Unitarian against Unitarian, his party, the Democratic Republican Party, got 80% of the Southern vote with support from the Baptists and the Methodists and the other religious minorities, while Adams and his Federalists, backed by the establishment churches in New England, got an even higher percentage of the vote in the North. Nevertheless, the Democratic Republicans, by virtue of taking the state of New York, got more votes in the Electoral College. But Jefferson and Democratic Republican vice presidential candidate Aaron Burr were tied in the Electoral College because the separate balloting for president and vice president had not yet been instituted. So all the electors voted for both of them, time after time, and they came out with a tie. Then it went into the House of Representatives. Jefferson eventually won the election in the Federalist-controlled House of Representatives when his archenemy, Alexander Hamilton, heroically persuaded one Federalist representative to stop voting for Aaron Burr in order to break the tie and let Jefferson win. So that's how Jefferson became president. It was a very close situation. But the relevant point here is that in 1800, Jefferson and the Democratic Republican Party won a victory for the anti-establishment, keep state and religion separate, sacred liberty view over the pro-establishment, divine authority view. Jefferson's view that there should be, quote, a wall of separation between church and state, unquote, had prevailed in this election. But after the election of James Monroe in 1816, as is pointed out in Church's article, the wall seemed less necessary because the establishment churches lost their political franchise. For example, Baptists, Episcopalians, and Methodists worked together to get a new state constitution in Connecticut, which guaranteed equal rights to all denominations, thus ending public financial support just for the Congregationalists. The last state to give up its right to require citizens to support religion was the state of Massachusetts in 1833. There, the law had allowed the government to use public money to support, quote, an institution for the public worship of God, unquote, if none were otherwise available in the community, and to require attendance in order to be taught by those hired to be public Protestant teachers of piety, religion, and morality. Church ends his article like this. I'm quoting now. With the collapse of New England's standing orders, the battle to save the American government, either from French infidelity on the one hand or Puritan theocracy on the other, had finally ended, the first culture war in the United States. Only with the coming of the Civil War and the emergence of Abraham Lincoln as national theologian did God re-enter the White House. But that is another story, and that's the end of Church's article. Skipping forward to the 1920s, the political battle between the pro-Enlightenment champions of science on the one hand and the religious fundamentalists on the other shifts to what gets taught in the public schools with regard to Darwin's theory of evolution. So we have a new culture war going in the 1920s. In 1925, in a plain case of religious intervention in the political sphere, the Tennessee State Legislature passed a law forbidding teachers in the state schools and colleges to teach, quote, any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, unquote. This law, ruling out the teaching of evolution, was the basis of the famous Scopes Monkey Trial in Dayton, Tennessee, in which former U.S. presidential candidate William Jennings Bryan was a witness for the prosecution, and Chicago lawyer Clarence Darrow, paid by the American Civil Liberties Union, was chief counsel for the defendant John Scopes. Scopes was found guilty in this trial and fined $100. But the media throughout the world mocked the ignorance of the fundamentalist Christians who cheered Bryan and the verdict of guilt, as well as the whole state of Tennessee. But the battle, the culture battle, continued to be focused on the public schools and the teaching of the theory of evolution. The fundamentalists have conducted a continuous campaign to get their supporters elected to school boards and to support the teaching of intelligent design as an alternative to the theory of evolution. In December 2005, Federal Circuit Judge John Jones III, in a case involving a school board in Dover, Pennsylvania, ruled, quote, creationism, intelligent design, and other claims of supernatural intervention in the origin of life or of species are not science because they are not testable by the methods of science, end of quote. In December 2007, just last month, Christine Castillo Comer was forced to resign her position as science education director of the Texas Education Agency because she had sent an email message to some teachers to inform them of a lecture being given by Barbara Forrest, a philosopher of science who is a hated enemy of the creationists. It seems that Comer would have had a central role in the coming review of the science education standards incorporated in the Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills document. And her sending of the email was taken as evidence that she is not neutral on the intelligent design issue. Another strategy of the fundamentalists has been to argue for teaching courses about the Bible in public schools, and then using textbooks that propagandize rather than presenting the material in an objective fashion. A group called the National Council on Bible Curriculum in Public Schools promotes the use of textbooks that promote a fundamentalist Protestant view of the Bible. So this is where the culture war is taking place at the moment. It seems that the best way to deal with these efforts to discuss evolution versus creationism in the schools is to do it in philosophy courses rather than in science courses. Then one could provide the arguments for and against not only the theory of evolution, but also for and against accepting the biblical accounts in a literal way. You'd have to deal with the pros and cons of all these different points of view. If the fundamentalists want to play the game this way, let their children learn to think for themselves rather than just be indoctrinated to believe whatever their parents want them to believe. I also believe it is time for the opponents of the fundamentalists to stop being so fearful and deferential to them. The statement that everything in the Bible is true needs to be openly challenged every time that it is uttered. If someone asserts that everything in the Bible is true, the proper response is to ask, "Do you believe that absolutely everything in the Bible is literally true?" If the answer is yes, then you can ask some specific questions. Do you believe that the sun and the moon were created on the fourth day, as is stated in Genesis 1, 13 to 16? How could there be days and daylight before there was a sun? Isn't it obvious that whoever wrote that did not know that day and night are caused by the revolution of the earth on its axis, and that the sun is the source of our daylight? Or you could ask them whether or not plants already existed when God created Adam. You could note that Genesis 1, 11 to 29 indicates that plants were created before Adam was created, but that Genesis 2, 4 to 7 says very clearly that there were no plants before Adam was created. So we have a case where the Bible is actually contradicting itself in the first and second chapters of Genesis. The culmination of this questioning about whether they accept the literal truth of everything in the Bible is whether they accept Mark 10, 18 and Luke 18, 19, which is easy to remember, Luke 18th chapter, 19th verse, where Jesus is reported to have said, "Why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone." The words are exactly the same in both accounts. If you believe that everything in the Bible is literally true, why do you not accept these verses? Returning then to the issue of the role of politics and religion, you could ask them if they think that it would be a good idea to have a law calling for severe punishment of anyone who does not accept the view that God alone is good and that that term should not be applied to Jesus. Do you think that would be a good idea? It is wrong to allow people to have some particular religious view to use whatever political power they have to require others to believe and act in accord with those ideas. We can see this clearly when the religious views of the politically powerful are different from our own. We should be able to see that the same principle should be followed when the views of the politically powerful happen to be the same as our own.